Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Nicholson Baker, whose new book is Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. We'll also hear from Hortensia Calvo, who's the director of the Latin American Library at Tulane University. Nicholson Baker is one of America's best-known novelists, author of such well-known works as Vox, Fermata, The Anthologist, The Mezzanine, and House of Holes. But he's also written some amazing and absorbing nonfiction, You and I, Human Smoke, Double Fold, among them. Today we'll be talking about his wonderful new book of nonfiction, Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. It's a great pleasure to speak with him today. Nick Baker, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I love this book. Reading it was such a complex experience. You put the reader in your place, of course, as the substitute is just trying to teach something in a single day. Are the frustrated teachers you're sometimes helping in person as an ed tech, and then those kids who are facing so many challenges. It's such a complex social environment.
You know, you hit it on the head. That's what it is. What fascinated me was how many cross currents, how much is going on in any given classroom at any moment. So many personalities and their old grudges and rivalries and people wanting to be funny and people wanting to be bad, people wanting to excel academically, and it's sort of swirling around the teacher. And it's really richer and more complicated than I ever would have imagined.
So what possessed you in the first place? I mean, did you just wake up one day and think, I know what I want to do now. I'll be a substitute teacher.
Well, my son was in high school. He talked about this one sub who was kind of an interesting guy. It gradually dawned on me that the only way I was going to have the privilege of being in a class as a functional participant, rather than, you know, it's easy to ask for permission to observe a class, and that's one way to write a book about education, is to observe the class. But as a real participant in the class, short of actually getting a teaching degree, the way to do it is to become a substitute teacher. It's also a better way to get introduced to a lot of different grades levels and skill levels. So one day it's remedial math in eighth grade, let's say, and the next day it's kindergarten. You know, you never know. Whereas a real teacher, a seasoned teacher, generally has a subject or a grade level or something like that. So I decided to do that, and I said to my son, I think I want to become a substitute teacher because I want to write a book about it. And he said, Dad, they will crush you. You know, don't do it. And it's true. There was a lot of attempted crushing involved.
Oh, my gosh. I love the way you kind of shied away from the kindergartners, you know?
I have two kids, and they're grown now.
Right.
And I had just forgotten how little, but how really smart and how clear-eyed and how observant little kids are. But they're scary because whatever happens in that class is not based on authority or anything. It's based on what the teacher can make happen in talking to those little people. Tiny desks, tiny chairs, and they are innocent. And they're also being expected to learn to read really, really early now. So there's a fair amount of pressure on kindergartners and first graders that wasn't true when I was that age. I was kind of a late reader. So I looked at them and thought, my God, they're really having to be troopers here.
I wondered, too, if those high school English students knew how lucky they were to have you even for a day.
And it's very kind of you to say they were lucky because I'm a working writer. I found it very difficult to teach those classes because I didn't understand what they wanted from the students. First, let me say, one of the great discoveries that I made as a substitute teacher was that there were only a few things that would get a class to really quiet down. One of them was the Pledge of Allegiance. Everybody would talk in unison. People stopped being jostled and distracted, and they would do that. But the other thing that they almost always did if I read aloud a chapter of, let's say, a Roald Dahl novel or some other young adult book or something, they almost always went completely quiet to listen to the book that I was reading. Fiction read aloud, at least in this particular school district in Maine, was the most efficient way to get a class to sit still and be quiet and be attentive over all grade levels. That was amazing. And it made me really thrilled to have been at times a fiction writer, because it actually seems to have a special spell still. Even in this kind of internet-saturated age, it's still, there's something that happens when fiction is read aloud, and that's terrific.
Well,
but analyzing stories is a different thing. And that's what I was supposed to do, was help them analyze Edgar Allan Poe story or something.
But love that they seemed so happy when you were reading to them. Those were some of the happiest moments in the story. And you were discovering some wonderful books yourself, Hatchet and Esperanza Rising. And, you know, you got a little tour of YA literature as well.
Yeah, Hatchet, oh my God. I was reading Hatchet aloud, and I didn't know anything about it. I picked up wherever the real teacher had gotten to and started reading, and I started to get choked up. The story was so good, you know, thinking, wow, this is a little miniature miracle that's happening here. Over and over again, I felt, in a sense, because the substitute is so low prestige, I'm under the students, I'm under the custodians, but I felt like I was a student. When a teacher next door would come in and scold the class for being loud, I felt like I was being scolded. And when we discovered a book that was fun to read aloud, I was discovering it too. So it was a very immersive experience for me personally.
Now, you really do take us through the day, starting with that call at 5:30 or 5:45 to go to a particular school, and the surprise of going to work at so many different places and having to snap into an environment that quickly. But you did get to go to some of the same schools more than once, so you had a chance to see some of the kids again, and I think that was important for you.
Well, yes, some of the kids who are really struggling, or some of the kids who are maybe over-medicated, I wanted to be sure that, you know, things were turning out okay for them, because you can't help but become attached to people who are working this hard to be unique human beings. I mean, you know, it is hard to be any sort of person. You have to master language and figure out some way to be funny and interesting and true and all that. And they are all working really hard at this, to the point of exhaustion sometimes. So it was really a pleasure to be able to go back to a certain elementary school, let's say. I loved these kids. I mean, the intent of the book is to help a reader, to some extent anyway, feel some of that affection that I felt for them as they kind of struggled their way through the day.
Well, there is so much tenderness in this book. So I would like to ask you to read one of my favorite passages, if that's all right. It's at the bottom of page 589, and it's been a long day, and you're about to send the kids off to gym class.
Oh, yes. I think this is kindergarten. So the last thing I did in the end of the day was I read them a little of Hop on Pop, and I was amazed that they had already sort of semi-memorized the book. I said, your brain's figured all this out. It's pretty incredible. And then there was this unhappiness that arose because one kid said another kid was stupid, and there was a whole argument. And I said, guys, I want to say something very important, which is that I've watched all of you. I'm 100% convinced that every one of you is an incredibly good kid. In general, you're good listeners, you're good workers, you're nice to each other. Every so often, there seems to be a tension. As far as I can tell, the things that you disagree about are very tiny. If you didn't let yourself be bothered by what somebody else did, it probably wouldn't be a bad thing. So my suggestion is to just sort of go with the flow. The class was listening. So I went on. And here's the thing that I understand about this school that I can see, I said. People tell you what to do all the time. Isn't that true? All day long. You're being told what to do. It's exhausting. I would be exhausted. In lunch, they tell you what to do. In recess, they tell you what to do. Line up. Be quiet. Do this. Do that. And there's a lot of learning you have to do. It's hard, and I understand that. I want to say, I really admire you guys. I mean it. From my heart, I admire what you're doing. I didn't want them to see that I had tears in my eyes, so I looked at the clock. And now it's time to go to gym, where they will also tell you what to do.
Wow. I was so moved by that.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this. You know, it's such a page-turner of a book. The rhythm of the day is so interesting. The kids are so funny. Your struggles are so real. There's something really magical about this book.
Thank you so much for saying that. That really makes my month. I appreciate it.
Well, good. We've been talking with Nicholson Baker, whose wonderful and very warm new book is Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. Nick, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Hortensia Calvo is the Dora Stone Director of the Latin American Library at Tulane University. She's a scholar of colonial Spanish American literature, the work of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, and print culture and the history of the book in Latin America. Today we'll be talking about what a treasure the Latin American Library really is. Hortensia, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Susan.
Oh, well, thanks. Now, the Latin American Library has this long history that goes all the way back to 1924. And like so much of New Orleans, it's a colorful history.
It certainly is. It's a wonderful institution that many in New Orleans don't know it exists. Many don't know that we have one of the foremost Latin American collections in the country here. And yes, the colorful history begins in 1924 with the founding of the library by a large donation from a New Orleans businessman. There was a large collection that was going to come up at auction of all kinds of original books and documents relating to indigenous cultures from the earliest part of the Spanish arrival in the New World. And Tulane, with this donation, wanted to found a pioneering institute that still exists today. It's known as the Middle American Research Institute. And the Latin American Library was the library of the institute at that time. And the president of Tulane traveled to New York and gave the money to buy the collection en masse. And that is how it arrived in New Orleans, and it never came up to auction.
Well, what I love about it so much is that it's like a collective obsession. You know, specialty libraries, they're the result of obsessive natures. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it's funny you should say that, because along with the collection came its first director, who was the person who had amassed this collection. He was a marvelous collector. A very obsessive person when it came to doing research on what was needed to study, particularly indigenous languages at the time, which was the forte of the collection. So he worked himself into the deal, and he arrived in New Orleans and quickly came to dominate the collection. He got involved in all sorts of business enterprises in Central America, in Mexico, and he only lasted for 2 years.
Oh, but you know, that's kind of a book collector's dream to go somewhere with your books, you know, and find a home for them.
Absolutely. And he certainly did. Unfortunately, some bad blood prevailed, but he was gone and a wonderful collection and a wonderful institute remained.
And this was a time when, in the 30s, we were learning a lot about Latin America, and we were learning a lot about the books of Latin America, right?
Absolutely. What's interesting at that time is that it's the beginning of a very important moment in book publishing in Latin America. The Spanish Civil War was in the 1930s, And at the conclusion of the Spanish Civil War, with the rise of Francisco Franco, many of the intelligentsia who were anti-Franco came particularly to Argentina and to Mexico. And there they founded publishing houses. Many of them were involved in the publishing business in Spain. Publishing in Spain virtually ceases during and after the Civil War. And then the other place that Latin American writers would turn to was France. And then with World War II, that publishing scene ceases. So Latin America starts publishing its own materials. So that's when we get the great publishing houses. And for those of your listeners who are familiar with the so-called boom writers, in the 50s, particularly the 1960s, I'm talking about Mario Vargas Llosa and, of course, Gabriel García Márquez, and even Borges, who was a precursor to them. Borges began publishing in the 1940s. This publishing boom was really what made possible this literary boom later on. So it's a very exciting moment in, in the production of books in Latin America.
And New Orleans has always had this abiding interest in Latin America and close connection to it. And Tulane has enhanced and strengthened that connection.
Absolutely. One of the things that is not so widely known in New Orleans and in much of the United States is that the first Spanish language newspaper that was published in the United States was published right here in 1808.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Absolutely. It was called El Mississippi with an accent on the last I. So before the Civil War, there are at least 24 known Spanish language newspapers published in New Orleans.
That's amazing.
That speaks to the readership that it could sustain. They weren't simultaneous, of course, but that there would be continuously published Spanish language newspapers in the city tells you a lot about the vibrant literary culture in the Spanish language.
So tell us about some of the things in the collection that you love. What's one of the things that's most often used, for example?
Oh, what's most often used is actually our circulating collection, which many people tend to think that what makes a library great are the few pieces that are treasures. And certainly that is true, and we have plenty of them. But what most people don't realize is that what makes a collection great, that's why the United States has such wonderful libraries, is the constant and continuous funding and support to buy the latest publications according to a certain scope and parameters year in and year out. So if you do that since 1924, you have one of the world's greatest collections on Latin America.
Now, one other thing that I know is very dear to your heart and that you've worked very hard to develop is the image archive.
Absolutely. We have one of the few image archives devoted solely to Latin America in the United States. Right now, we have over 150,000 pieces.
Wow.
And we call it an image archive because, of course, we have photographs. We have some of the earliest photographs taken in Latin America from the mid-19th century up until the present. But we also have stereoscopic glass slides. Some of them are hand-painted.
Wow.
We have plain slides. We have all kinds of images and graphic items, such as original design drawings by William Spratling,
who is really a source of fascination to so many New Orleanians for his connection with Faulkner, establishing the silver industry. He's a great character, too. Now, one of the things that fascinates me about your job is that, and I've held jobs like this, so I kind of know what the challenge is, but it's a job of stewardship. It's a job of caring for something that you know will be there long after you're gone. So how do you go about like setting personal goals for something like that? What do you want the Latin American Library legacy of yours to be?
That's a wonderful question, because one of the things that I love about my job is that I feel that I am part of something greater than me. I feel I'm part of a history. I'm part of a distinguished institution, and I have the honor of carrying out the work of so many wonderful people who came before and take it into the present and the future. So it is a bit challenging. It isn't about the day-to-day, but you always have to be thinking about the future. You have to be thinking about where is the library going? Am I taking it in the right direction? It's about the service that you give to these collections. Just because you have great collections, what are they good for if people don't know they're there? So there's all this work of making them discoverable, of helping people make the collections speak. And that is always a challenge.
Well, that's one of the things you do so well, because you work so hard to make the Latin American Library part of the larger literary community. And you always have something happening. You always have an exhibit. You know, something's going on there. It's an exciting place to visit. So tell us about your big event this fall coming up very soon.
Yes, November 9th. We are having a very exciting event that I'd like your listeners to know about. This will be a dialogue between two of the foremost writers from Mexico in the world today. One is Jorge F. Hernandez, and he lives in Madrid. He is a novelist, and he also is a journalist. And then our very own Yuri Herrera, whom you have interviewed.
He's had a great year with his new book.
He's wonderful as a person and as a writer. And I say our very own because he teaches at Tulane in the Spanish and Portuguese department. So we're going to have an event. It will be in part of Words and Music, and it's co-hosted with my dear friend Rosemary James and Joe DeSalvo, who are the founders of the Faulkner Society and put on this wonderful New Orleans event, which it can't happen anywhere else in the world.
It's one of the highlights of every fall.
Absolutely. Words and Music. So we're doing this event at the Latin American Library, and it will be at 5:30 in the afternoon, and it will be in the form of a dialogue between these two writers who, even though they live in different countries, they drink from the same traditions. And they will be talking about Latin American literature today and about the topics that they write about, which is current realities in Mexico and immigration and other topics of interest.
And that's Wednesday, November 9th at 5:30 at the Woldenberg Arts Center Auditorium.
Yes, and it will be followed by a reception at the Latin American Library, where we will also have an exhibit of Mexican literature.
Well, that'll be a big night. We've been talking with Hortensia Calvo, who's the Doris Stone Director of the Latin American Library at Tulane University. You can meet her Wednesday, November 9th at 5:30 at the Freeman Auditorium of the Woldenberg Arts Center for the talk, and then that will be followed by a reception at the Latin American Library. Hortensia, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This has been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Best-selling author Daniel Jose Older, author of Shadow Shaper, Salsa Nocturna, and Half Resurrection Blues, appears Tuesday, November 1st at 7:30 at the Norman Mayer Branch Library to do a Q&A with Wild Seeds, the New Orleans Octavia Butler Emergent Strategy Collective. Catherine Alto discusses and signs The Natural World of Winnie the Pooh through the forest that inspired The Hundred Acre Wood, Tuesday, November 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Novelist Jonathan Robb discusses In Signs Among the Living, Tuesday, November 1st at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center. David Johnson, local writer and journalist, leads a discussion of Sun, Stone, and Shadows, 20 Great Mexican Short Stories, Tuesday, November 1st at 7 at the Eastmack Regional Library in Metairie. A tape version of the Friends of the Cabildo lecture featuring LSU history professor Gaines M. Foster, Memories of the Civil War, What Americans Think About the Civil War, and What They Should Think, will be broadcast Wednesday, November 2nd at 7 at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library. That's in Harvey. Mike Corrado discusses and signs his children's book, Little Elliot, Big Fun, Thursday, November 3rd at 3:30 at Octavia Books. Yvonne Spear-Perrette signs her new book, Simone of New Orleans, about the well-known New Orleans artist, Thursday, November 3rd at the French Library, 3811 Magazine Street, from 5:30 to 7:30. Rick Barton and Joanna Leek celebrate the 25th anniversary of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop with the publication of the book, Monday Nights, Stories from the Creative Writing Workshop of the University of New Orleans. That's Thursday, November 3rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Join them, along with contributors Tad Bartlett, Robin Bodier, Andrea Bull, Amanda Boyden, Joseph Boyden, Karen Chapman, Jeannie Cunningham, Chris Darkwater, Leah Downing, Barb Johnson, Jennifer Ann Gukta, A.C. Lambeth, Nicholas Maneri, Craig McWhorter, K.L. Owens, David Parker, April Blevins-Pevchik, Carolyn Ranu, Maurice Ruffin, Neil Walsh, Missy Wilkinson, and Larry Wormington. Dr. Jerry Ward reads from and signs his new book of poems, Fractal Song, from Black Widow Press, Thursday, November 3rd at 6 at the New Orleans Museum of Music and Cultural Arts. That's adjacent to Crescent City Books at 124 Barone Street. Liz Williams discusses and signs Lift Your Spirits, a celebratory history of cocktail culture in New Orleans, Thursday, November 3rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Terry Paul Lafarge and Cheryl Spates sign The Very First Christmas Stocking and the Gifts of the Seven Coins, Saturday, November 5th at noon at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. The Latin American Library at Tulane partners with the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society to present a discussion of this year's Big Read, Wednesday, November 9th from 6 to 9:30 at the Freeman Auditorium at Tulane. This year's focus book is Sun, Stone, and Shadows, a collection of the best Mexican short fiction curated, edited, and translated by Mexican author Jorge Hernandez, one of Mexico's leading journalists and author of both fiction and nonfiction. Hernandez appears with Tulane professor Yuri Herrera, whose most recent book is Transmigration of Bodies. Today's guest, Hortensia Calvo, will moderate that discussion. Pirate Sally Faulkner Society presents its annual Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, November 9th through 13th at various locations, headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone. For more information and tickets, go to wordsandmusic.org. Also coming up in November, the New Orleans Book Festival takes place November 11th and 12th in City Park. Here are some of the authors who'll be attending: Jeff Abbott, Elise Arden, Johnette Downing, Greg Isles, Fred LeBlanc, and many, many more. For information, go to nolabookfest.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.